Hello, this is Stephanie.
And this is Brian.
Welcome to the making and the remaking of A Codependent Mind, both the podcast and the book. In this episode, Brian's going to be reading Chapter 3 on Human Connection. If you're enjoying listening to the book, if you could do us a favor and head over to Amazon and leave a review, that would be very helpful. It helps others find the book and the podcast. Now here's Brian.
Chapter 3, Human Connection. All humans crave connection. It's who we are as a species. Behavior disorders like codependency can make it difficult to form those connections. The codependent behaviors kept me safe by hiding my true self from other people. Eventually, I was hiding from myself as well. There was no way to connect with others when I was so disconnected, so fragmented. By the time my childhood friend G had exited my life in fifth grade, I had a fairly complex system of false signals and misguided reactions that were not setting me up for interpersonal success. From my parents, I learned that other people's needs and emotional responses were not only more important than mine, but that they were my responsibility to manage. Other people's emotions were unpredictable and sometimes chaotic and frightening. During my friendship with G, my codependent habits deepened. Having needs, desires, even feelings of my own felt off-limits, even dangerous. My body became accustomed to being on constant threat alert, and I was not prepared for what it would take to form healthy relationships going forward. While other children were learning who they were as individuals, discovering sources of personal power, learning about their emotions, figuring out how to navigate the complicated world of interpersonal relationships, I was doing none of that. Instead of learning about myself, I was focused on learning about other people so I could manage their emotions and behaviors. Instead of figuring out my own wants, needs, and desires and how to achieve them, I was becoming very adept at figuring out what other people wanted, needed, or desired, and how to deliver on those. I was in a suspended state of unhealed trauma and emotional immaturity, with growing layers of shame, fear, and resentment. A new source of shame that came about for me not too long after G moved away was sexual shame, which quickly became severe. Suddenly, it seemed as though everyone was talking about sex, particularly the boys I was around in school and in Boy Scouts. I had no idea what they were talking about or how to find out. I was starting to get very clear messages from those around me what it meant to be a boy or a man, how to behave and not behave. As far as I could tell, I wasn't living up to any of those expectations. The layers of shame I was carrying, especially the sexual shame, added to my sense of isolation. I was in constant fear of being exposed for my ignorance and lack of life experience. I didn't see myself as worthy of being part of the social interactions that were going on around me. But as separate as I felt, I still desperately wanted, needed to belong. But where and with whom? I had to fit in, but I couldn't manage to figure out how. Everyone else seemed to know who they were and how and where they fit in, but I had no clue. Overall, my social landscape was one of extreme powerlessness and anxiety. I mostly kept myself small and inconsequential, in hopes of avoiding being a target. My powerless approach to social interactions, combined with the ways I felt about myself, led me to passively just accept whoever came along and chose me. As a result, and not surprisingly, I usually wound up becoming involved with others who also struggled with their self-image, or who were socially or emotionally dysfunctional. Codependency and other behavior disorders. Emotionally mature people interested in authentic relationships aren't looking for someone who agrees with everything they say. They don't need or even want people to go out of their way to diffuse their painful emotions or try to match everything they do. In other words, they don't need or want the kind of skills I developed as a child and young adult, skills I needed to make me feel safe. Unfortunately, there are plenty of people out there who are looking to others for compliance and deference, who need it, who demand it. Those were the types of people that I mostly became involved with, and sadly, these relationships often devolved into abusive relationships. However, before I get into my relationships with abusive disordered people, I think it would be helpful to explain how things worked with a person from my past who was not abusive, but who was still very much a disordered person. In some ways, he was similar to me, but in many ways different. This was my friend E. He and I were best friends for about 12 years, from late high school to well beyond college, and it was, up to that time and for a fairly long time afterwards, the closest thing to a safe, connected, intimate relationship that I had. In fact, to this day, it is still the longest relationship I've been in, not counting my family. E and I had very similar upbringings and similar traumatic experiences. Both of us struggled to understand and express our emotions, and both of us found ourselves behaving in ways that we developed to cope with our unhealed traumas. These behaviors doing less and less through the years to actually help us cope. We'd talk for hours, mostly about the world around us, offering our interpretations of it, although only occasionally hinting at our emotional experiences. Despite our connection and our many talks about life, ourselves, and the world, neither of us managed to gain the emotional awareness we needed to understand what was holding us back. Every year it became more and more difficult for each of us to relate to anyone outside of the safety of our two-person bubble. We increasingly leaned on each other and co-isolated. We would have regular conversations about our desires to find romantic partners, but always fell short of putting in the effort to make that happen. I had too much shame and fear, especially when it came to my lack of sexual experience, so the romantic realm felt off-limits to me, almost impossible. We each struggled with depression and would go through periods of heavy alcohol use. E started to struggle pretty severely emotionally. I did as well, but I was better at compartmentalizing and avoiding all of the emotional signals I was getting, so I kept myself mostly numb. E's emotional challenges, however, intensified as time went on. Rather than trying to actually help him, though, I went to work with my codependent responses and tried to regulate E's emotions. If he was unsatisfied with something, I'd go out of my way to curate his experience. If he was uncomfortable with his surroundings, I'd go out of my way to alter them. E's distress scared me. I needed him to feel safe because his sense of safety was crucial to mine. The more he seemed to need it, the more I took on a caretaking role. Even though he wasn't demanding that I do so, I regularly denied my own wants, needs, and desires to support him in any way I could. He wanted to play music for a living, and I went to work trying to figure out how to make that happen, spending hours every day researching the music industry and spending thousands of dollars setting up a studio. I even convinced myself that I wanted that same dream. When he struggled financially, I responded by combining our finances and assuring him that it was all fine, it was all for the greater good, and everything would work out someday. When he found himself needing to escape using tools like alcohol, I not only enabled it, I joined in. In spite of all those efforts to help, I wasn't necessarily being empathetic. Actually, my caretaking involved very little care. If E expressed dissatisfaction or worried about his situation or his future, I was quick to dismiss his feelings with a "it'll be okay, don't worry" comment. I would deny him the reality of his feelings because I was in denial. Deep down, I knew our situation wasn't good, but I was afraid. I didn't want to lose the only safe person I had ever met by trying something different. Eventually, things got too difficult for E, and he needed more help than I can give. He needed professional help. As a result, we had to go our separate ways. I regret how hard things got for him, and how little what I did actually helped. In fact, I sometimes feel that my efforts actually had the opposite effect. Because at the same time E was struggling, I was also trying to figure out what was wrong with me. Why am I depressed? Why am I anxious? Why am I socially awkward? And so my own confusion and my codependent and somewhat self-centered behaviors, behaviors I thought were driven by my desire to help E, but to a degree reflected my knee-jerk need to protect myself, might have, and probably did, make things worse. What I don't regret from the years of friendship with E was that I had what I still describe as an intimate relationship during a very difficult period of my life. That relationship planted within me a seed of the value, worth, and importance of intimate, supportive connections. Even though it was challenging for me in the years to come to access the memory of that aspect of my relationship with E, the muscle memory of that connection got lodged in my subconscious and would come in handy eventually. Relationships with narcissists. One of my earliest discoveries around the time I realized I was codependent was that the most damaging relationships I've experienced were with narcissistic people. Consequently, I've done quite a bit of reading and researching into narcissism and its connection to codependency. Looking back, I realized I had multiple friendships during my childhood and early adulthood with people whose behaviors were narcissistic. My first two romantic relationships were with women who were extremely narcissistic. I have done extensive reflection on the types of behaviors those friends and romantic partners had, the ways in which they were almost identical to each other, the ways in which they differed, the ways in which I was affected, and how my behaviors looked during those relationships. Relationships between people with codependent behaviors and people with narcissistic behaviors are especially problematic. Not only did narcissistic behaviors activate my codependent behaviors in the most severe way, my relationships with narcissistic people led to new layers of shame and trauma, and brought me dangerously close to ending my life. For that reason, I feel the need to spend some time laying out what I've found to be the most common narcissistic behaviors and how those behaviors interact with codependent behaviors. The codependency and narcissism connection. Codependency and narcissism, like many behavioral disorders, are most commonly a response to trauma. They are strategies for survival, coping mechanisms to deal with the trauma and to attempt to achieve some level of safety in threatening situations. Two people can have very similar experiences but develop completely different ways of coping with the resulting trauma. As it is with codependency, narcissism is a spectrum. Additionally, not all of the behaviors that are described as codependent or narcissistic are exclusive to people described as codependent or narcissistic. Anyone can exhibit codependent and/or narcissistic behaviors from time to time. I know that some of my behaviors over the years could be considered more narcissistic than codependent. It's useful, though, to think about what's driving those behaviors and how, in general, they can be clustered together. When people behave more one way than the other, we would call them a codependent person or a narcissistic person. Given that both can have roots in childhood trauma, it's not surprising that in some ways codependency and narcissism are similar. Despite how it may look from the outside, powerlessness and low self-esteem are very much at the center of both a narcissistic and a codependent person's experience. Narcissistic people and codependent people have difficulty interpreting, managing, and expressing their emotions. Both sets of behaviors can block empathetic responses and so make authentic human connection difficult. There is often a high level of self-centeredness that comes with narcissism and codependency, as much as it may look on the surface as though codependent people are more focused on other people. In many ways, however, the behaviors that make up codependency and narcissism are effectively polar opposites. One way to understand that opposition is to see it as opposing reactions to the threats of childhood. When under threat, by abuse, neglect, chaos, confusion, one response is to make yourself as small as possible, invisible, and align yourself with the most powerful actors around you, freeze and fawn. Another response is to make yourself as large as possible, invincible, and to attack or discard anyone who challenges you, fight and flight. The former is a path to codependency, the latter to narcissism. For the codependent person, the path to feeling secure is to try to make others feel comfortable at all costs. Compliance, people-pleasing, caretaking. Codependency is about putting other people's needs first with the hope that if other people feel safe and comfortable, so by extension will the codependent person. Narcissistic people take the opposite approach. They make it everyone else's responsibility to make them feel safe and comfortable. The cornerstones of narcissism, grandiosity, entitlement, lack of accountability, are about forcing their needs on everyone else. Grandiosity, entitlement, and lack of accountability. While codependent people often have a deflated sense of self, quick to see themselves as defective or undeserving, narcissistic people have an inflated sense of self. a grandiosity. I've observed this grandiosity in every person I've known with narcissistic behaviors. They all spent enormous amounts of time crafting an image that provided them with the highest level of validation, support, admiration, praise, or envy. Experiences, tastes, hobbies, job performance were all expressed in a grandiose way. Common refrains were that they were the first to do something or say something in a particular way, or that they were the number one fan of a musical group or an author or an activity. Then, to reinforce their superiority, there was always a hefty dose of dismissal, condescension, or belittlement of other people's tastes. Comments like, "You're not a real fan," or "You just started liking that because I did," or "You have boring tastes," are examples that were regularly directed at me or were expressed to me about others, including people the narcissist considered friends. As confident as the narcissistic person may appear, though, they are actually quite fragile. Every narcissistic person I've known was engaged in a seemingly never-ending search for people to validate them. When a person was found, the narcissistic person pulled them in and kept them close by whatever methods worked, and went out to look for more. Anyone who didn't validate their vision of themselves was avoided, discarded, or scorned. Alongside this need for validation was a deep-seated paranoia. They were on constant threat alert, and it was extremely destabilizing for them when they encountered people who didn't support the image they created of themselves. I remember well the sheer confusion that came when one of them didn't get the validation they expected, especially if the other person got too close to the truth and called them out on something. The immediate assumption was that there was something very wrong with the other person. That was the only acceptable conclusion. This inflated sense of importance and the need to feel special in turn fuels a deep sense of entitlement. Unlike myself, who struggled to feel entitled to even my own needs and desires, my narcissistic friends and partners felt entitled to just about everything. When they wanted something, they felt they deserved it and were owed it. When they perceived it as available, they would demand it. Their needs and desires were to be prioritized at all times. They expected preferential treatment from others, whether from close friends or complete strangers. They also felt entitled to other people, including me. My time, my money, my emotional space, my thoughts, my body, my sexuality were all to be available to them. Another core feature of narcissism is lack of accountability. Similar to how I would struggle to maintain empathy when in threat response mode, the narcissist in my life would often display a lack of empathy as well, especially when it involved how their own behavior affected others. When they behaved in such a way that upset other people, they were quick to dismiss those people's concerns and rationalize their actions. If ever I challenged their behavior, they would often run through what I have since learned is a common narcissistic script, represented by the acronym DARVO. They would deny, D, the behavior. "I was just joking," or "I never said or did that." They would attack, A, "You have no sense of humor," or "You're just stupid, weak, or a loser." And finally, they'd reverse the victim and offender, the RVO, roles, and decide that they were the ones being mistreated. "You never listened to me," or "You're lying, you tricked me," or "I'm sick, tired, or hungry, and you provoked me." As a person who was conditioned to respond with codependent behaviors, I was a perfect match for narcissistic people, as a friend or a romantic partner. Right from the start, I was prepared to validate and support their vision of themselves. My excessive agreeableness was exactly what they were looking for. They felt entitled to have all their needs and wants prioritized, and I was used to catering to the needs of other people, to the detriment of my own. My goal was to make everyone around me feel safe by taking responsibility for their emotions and experiences. And narcissistic people not only need this, they expect it and demand it. If those demands and expectations were extreme or even threatening, as they often were, my compulsion to continue to provide these things was even greater because I was conditioned to always respond to the biggest threat. And since narcissists are never wrong, I was there to help excuse their behavior, even when it involved abuse of others or even myself. Control. Everyone needs to feel as though they have some level of control over their lives. Achieving that feeling can be difficult for many people, especially those who struggle with emotional dysregulation or interpersonal disorders like codependency or narcissism. It can be frightening to feel as though we don't have control over our lives, and each individual's response to that fear is going to be different. Both of my parents struggle with their feelings of not being in control in different ways. My dad's response was more aggressive, controlling others by angry outbursts that elicited fearful compliance. My mom was much more passive, giving in to powerlessness and victimhood, thus enlisting other people's sympathy or validation. When a person becomes fixated on trying to change other people to their benefit, either passively or aggressively, things especially start to go awry, and we might call that person controlling. Codependent control is usually directed at managing other people's emotions. Because my parents' anger or distress, G's anger or distress, was scary and threatening to me, I developed certain behaviors that can be called controlling or manipulative. Behaviors such as lying, pretending to align myself with someone else's feelings, changing my behavior to mirror the behavior of another, dismissing or diminishing other people's painful emotions. However, there's also a passivity to such codependent control. For me, it wasn't about trying to change other people, but about trying to make them feel safe and that they had an unconditional ally in me. Narcissistic control is much more aggressive. For narcissists, feeling safe is about acting on their feelings of entitlement to use people in every way possible. Narcissistic control is about demanding others' time and energy, demanding compliance, demanding that people not only treat them the way they feel entitled to be treated, but that they be who they need them to be. Narcissists will also lie whenever they need to, in order to keep themselves in control of any situation or avoid any responsibility. Codependent and narcissistic control are both at the more severe end of the spectrum of controlling behaviors, but they're quite different in their overall effects on other people. Here's another way to contrast the motivations of codependency versus narcissism when thinking about controlling behaviors. Codependency is more about the need to fit with others to keep yourself safe. Codependent control is about trying to lead others to believe you're achieving that. Narcissism is about the need for others to fit with you. Narcissistic control is about trying to force others to do so. When these two manipulative personality types come together, it might seem their controlling behaviors mesh or counterbalance each other. However, this type of balance can't lead to an authentic, connected relationship that is healthy or empowering because its foundation is toxic at the very core.
And that concludes Chapter 3. We hope you'll join us in a couple of weeks for Chapter 4, Toxic Relationships. And again, if you would be so kind to leave a review on Amazon, we would much appreciate it.